Thirsty? You've come to the right place to wet your whistle. It's the Liquid Lifestyle with Ryan McGarian, a full hour of liquid refreshment. Now, here's Ryan. Everybody was dancing in
the moonlight. What's cracking, my thirsty listener? All right, so if the sound of my voice is flowing into your ears like a round and comforting Scottish ale, you know that you're riding the earth with me here at the Liquid Lifestyle on the Radio Northwest Network. And as always, I am your host and on-air bartender, Ryan McGarian, where today we are recording, as we quite often do, from the heart of my little cured ham and cocktail bar slash Oasis Hamlet here in Portland's Pearl District. And if you're joining us for the very first time, this little show of mine is generally dedicated to all things liquid and delicious. Specifically, we love talking spirits, we love talking cocktails and beers and wines and coffee and tea, with occasional forays into other spaces that I think you, my liquid listener, might enjoy, along with, of course, the fine folks and joints that serve all of these bad boys up, be them right here in the city of roses, hops, and hipsters, or as you might have experienced in past episodes, parts far, far beyond. All right, so today I am riding shotgun with one of the world's most respected authorities on both beer and whiskey. Good grief, like those are two things that anybody I think would want to be a respected authority on. And that's my guest, Stuart Ramsey. Stuart, how the heavens are you this fine P-Town Saturday afternoon?
I am doing very well, thank you. I'm glad to be in Portland.
So now remind me, you live here, right?
Yeah, I moved to Portland from Seattle about over 30 years ago. And I was managing the first brewpub in the country. There was no other brewpub at the time. It shows you how long ago this was, you know, over 30 years. And I was asked by the Ponzi family, who owned Bridgeport, would I basically create the pub for Bridgeport Brewing Company.
Well, let me jump in real quick because I don't want to go too fast. So what was the first brew pub? Tell me about that experience. Was it Grant's? Is that what it was?
Excellent observation. I was writing for the Seattle Weekly, and what I missed when I emigrated from Scotland was a good football game, and we found that eventually, of course, and beer, real ale. I grew up with what's called real ale. Or cask conditioned beer, and I was heavily involved with that style of beer, and you've seen the beer engines behind it and so forth, and I was involved with the biggest consumer movement in Europe, which was CAMRA, Campaign for Real Ale. And when I emigrated to the United States, and my whole point was to keep traveling around the world and end up back in Scotland, turns out I fell in love with the Pacific Northwest, and luckily over the course of 15-20 years, you know, we've got these brilliant soccer teams right now, and we've got absolutely stunning beers that eventually, you know, when we actually started off making beer, over time the British copied the Pacific Northwest. So all the stuff, you know, beers, like seasonal beers and that type of thing, we were teaching the Brits, you know, how to make beer and so forth.
So we took their styles and turned them into our own Northwest kind of situations, a la the India Pale Ale and so many other beers. And then they kind of returned the favor and looked at some of the goofy stuff, goofy and delicious, I might add, stuff we were doing, and started to apply it to their craft. Is that, would that sum it up pretty well?
I would say that. In the early days, you had ale. You didn't have, you know, Pilsner or lager styles of beer, whether they, you know, the temperature, the conditioning, and so forth. So it was really classic sort of ales. If you looked at you know, Pyramid Brewing, who originally were out of Kalama, of all places, you know, and it was basically a couple of hippies that started it, making ales. Bridgeport, similar thing, heavily influenced by, you know, British styles of beer. The Widmers were also there, and yeah. go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I would love to, I mean, we kind of jumped aside real quick to talk about that first brew pub, and I love the kind of context you've just given us. I want to get back into your story in particular. So you end up, developing the brew pub at Bridgeport, which to my mind was the first Portland brew pub for the most part, right?
Yeah, a little bit later you saw the McMinimans, and I think it was on the Hillsborough, or Hillsdale, my apologies, where they actually had a brewery, brew pub. But what I tried to do in at Bridgeport was create this sort of hybrid place, which was based on a sort of a serious Scottish pub, where there was, you know, basically you stood at the bar. Everything was about the beer, and but I also wanted it to be Northwest. So I ended up, for example, trading books with Powell's, so that we had a library in the place. So there was this sort of European kind of mix thrown into it, in addition to sort of what I would call a classic Scottish sort of pub. And I just felt that it was something that would work. You know, before, and here we are in the Pearl District. I was there when it wasn't called the Pearl District. It was Northwest Industrial. But it was remarkable the kind of people that discovered that first, you know, Bridgeport pub.
Man, it's been there a while. Once again, we're chatting with Stuart Ramsey, one of the world's great beer and wine experts. He's also the proprietor of a new business called Whiskey Back, which we'll be getting to in a little bit. But man, this is just already, I'm stoked, and you know, just hearkening back to the early days of Portland brew pubs. And you know, I remember I was tending bar at Bema. Remember Bema? Dude, Bema was a revelation. It was like the first Pearl District kind of cocktail bar slash, you know, like it was Gulf Coast food, man. I loved working there for the short time that I did. And I remember specifically when I worked doubles, I'd roll over to Bridgeport and crush a pint of IPA in between shifts just to keep my attitude in the right place. But so tell me about that early lineup of beers. Now, as I recall, were you the mind behind Blue Heron Pale Ale?
Yeah, that was a situation where the Audubon Society, all the folks who were involved with the Audubon Society, they'd drink at Bridgeport. And they said, okay, we got an idea for raising money. What do we do? And I says, well, we'll make a beer for you, and we'll give you like 15-20%, you know, of what we took in. Secretly, I wanted to make the classic Northwest Ale, which was a medium-bodied. All the grain came from the Northwest, all the hops came from the Northwest. It had more hops than the early Bridgeport had, but nowhere near the hops that a lot of breweries have today. It was very well balanced, and it was this sort of session beer that had real character to it. And so that was what I talked to, you know, the brewers about. Let's make this style of beer. And I called it, you know, basically the classic Northwest Ale, and nobody had ever called anything like that before. I still think it's a classic Northwest Ale, and until the Texans took over it and massacred on it and killed that chicken, it was a wonderful, you know, beer that came out of the Northwest.
And I also want to touch on, before we get to the end of the segment, the IPA from Bridgeport. That was kind of the first big deal American or Northwest style IPA, huh?
It was, and that came after I had left by this time, and the evolution of the early days, and it was years and years later that that style of beer came on board, and it's just interesting in terms of how far it's gone with you know, that style of beer, the you know, IPAs and so forth. Those early beers were not that, you know, they were more balanced beers. I talk about that first brew pub. It was a hop scientist who lived in Yakima, Washington, and I actually uprooted from Wallingford, or actually Capitol Hill in Seattle, dragged my wife over to Yakima, and because, you know, he was in a hop company, and he made his own beer.
Got to jump in real quick, Stuart. This is such a good conversation. Hope y'all are enjoying it. That's the end of round one. We will be back for round two in just a moment. And welcome back to the Liquid Lifestyle here on the Radio Northwest Network. I hope you're just chilling. I hope you're in. I just hope you're relaxing, enjoying a fine P-Town Saturday afternoon, and I hope you're enjoying this fine conversation we're having with Stuart Ramsey, one of the world's great, one of the definitive authorities on all things beer and whiskey. And we're really lucky to have him residing right here in P-Town. And if you missed the first segment, you know, Stuart was involved with the development of the first brew pubs pretty much in the Pacific Northwest, first Grants, and then later he developed with the Ponzi's the Bridgeport brew pub that probably most of you have been to, and helped develop Blue Heron Pale Ale, which now if you've been around, you know exactly what that bad boy is. And I tell you what, man, we ended the last segment talking about Bridgeport IPA. The first IPA I remember that first experience with like those really big booming hops, you know. And I mean, I guess before we jump, keep moving on your story, what are your thoughts on where IPAs have gone since? I mean, that was 20 years ago. IPAs have gone nuclear, haven't they? I mean, they've just gone in a lot of kind of crazy and exciting directions. What's your take on that, man?
Well, I'm kind of traditional old school. I like balance in my beer, and with the whiskey back. One of the things I notice when you pair spirits, in particular whiskey, with different styles of beer is if you have a beer that has a lot of hops in it and that kind of bite and that bitterness, there's not a lot of spirits that pair up well. So deliberately I've gone for a less kind of hoppier style of beer. I can't believe, even from the early days, the beers that were coming out, it was probably about 10-15 years into craft brewing that you saw these very heavily styles of beers with the hops. Bear in mind that, you know, the Yakima Valley, the Willamette Valley are two of the greatest places on the earth for growing hops, so it's not surprising, given the freshness of the hops, that they would be a little bit more balanced towards, you know, very bitter, very aromatic styles of beer. So compared to other areas where the hops might not be as fresh as what we have here in the Pacific Northwest. So it's kind of a logical development, experimenting. My gut feeling is we're going back a wee bit to a more balanced style of beer, whether we call it craft beer anymore, because, you know, so many people have taken that and, you know, kind of ruin the name and so forth. So it's almost like we need to have another, you know, term for what the local breweries are doing. You know, and a lot of it for me starts with local breweries, with local companies and consumers understanding what it is, you know, these brewers are creating and making and so forth.
And I have to agree with you there, Stuart. Once again, we're chatting with Stuart Ramsey, world whiskey and beer authority, who lives right here in P-Town. That IPAs, you know, the hops here in the Northwest, you know, they're like wild stallions. They are just bright and they kick like crazy. And then you got the folks down at Oregon State making all these beautiful hybrids. I mean, you got so much going on. So yeah, I agree with you. It's just kind of the fact that our IPAs have been so booming and sometimes resiny is just because it is kind of hard to tame the brightness of what we have here in the Pacific Northwest. But I'm also so stoked, like you said, to see this evolution and movement back towards sessionability and drinkability. And, you know, anybody who listens to this show knows I'm always talking about how much I love Barley Browns and the stuff Tyler Brown is doing, because I, you know, when I first tasted that Palate Jack from Barley Browns and then also the Breakside IPA that Ben's making over there at Breakside, I was like, whoa, you can have all that hop lusciousness, but you can also have a balanced beer. I didn't even know that you could do this. So it's been really exciting. And, you know, before we leave beer and go into whiskey, Stuart, I know you were you're a founding father of the Oregon Brewers Festival, correct?
Many years ago. It was Art Lawrence who basically came up with the idea, but I, along with Nancy Ponzi and Kurt Widmer, Art Lawrence and myself, we sort of sat down, you know, and said we're going to put on a festival. I think we ended up with like 10,000 people the first, and then over the years, Lord knows how many people goes to it now, and there's all offshoots from it. But my job there was to sort of, you know, take on the educational aspect of it, meaning the hop growers, meaning, you know, the maltsters, in large part because I thought the OLCC would close us down. So I wanted it to be educational. So that was kind of my role, sitting in with that group of folks who, you know, basically started the first three or four festivals.
Man, I tell you what, dude, that the Brewfest has always been like a highlight of my year. You know, I always say, if you want to see Oregon, there's two places you're going to see it, at the airport and at the Oregon Brewers Festival, because total, I guess the words, egalitarianism, like everybody goes, everybody feels good about themselves, you got families, you got, you know, you got everybody at the brew. It's such a beautiful thing that you guys have done there. Do you know, who started the famous roar? You know that roar that just gets, does anybody know where that started?
I think that's just called drunkenness after a while. It's I think if you go to, you know, Germany and Oktoberfest and stuff like that, you get crazy stuff happening. But, you know, just to watch it evolve from those early years and sort of just the, you know, either being headstrong, you know, and believing in beer, that's what came out of those early days and that original festival.
That's so cool, man. Once again, we're chatting with Stuart Ramsey, beer and whiskey authority par excellence. And man, we've chatted a ton about beer, but man, when I was you know, thinking about having you on the show, you know, actually the first thing that actually comes to mind, despite all your beer exposure, is whiskey. When I hear Stuart Ramsey, when I hear the name Stuart Ramsey, I think whiskey. So where so you at some point pivot professionally to a focus on whiskey. Does that happen right after kind of Bridgeport? When does that happen? I think it started with you writing a newsletter somewhere. Is that kind of where it started?
That's right. Well, I actually, when I worked at Bridgeport, I was also the marketing director for Bridgeport. I'd go to places like Jake's, you know, the early Jake's crawfish, and they had 10 or 12 bottles of single malt scotch. Nobody at the restaurant knew what the heck they were, but they were, you know, becoming popular right at the same time, you know, as good coffee, as, you know, varietal wines was coming in, you know, being popular. So I would invite all the employees at Jake's and McCormick and Schmick's and so forth down to Bridgeport and say, all this is distilled craft beer. Now bring your whiskey down and we'll sit down and taste all the whiskeys.
Actually got to jump in real quick. Man, as always, things are flying. That is the end of round two. You're listening to The Liquid Lifestyle, back for round three in just a moment. Welcome back to The Liquid Lifestyle here on the Radio Northwest Network, where we are chatting with Stuart Ramsey, one of the world's leading authorities on all things beer and whiskey. And if you've enjoyed the opportunity to listen to the first two segments, we've been really hitting hard on beer and Stuart's involvement in the early brew pubs in the region and the beer itself, helping develop the Bridgeport Brewery brew pub and being kind of a founding father at the Oregon Brewers Festival. And if that's not enough, now my man is going to start leading us into where he's gone in the past, really in the past 10 to 15 years, which is really focusing on the whiskey space. And just towards the end of the last segment, we talked about kind of your first foray into offering education here specifically in Portland, getting the Jakes and some of the McCormick and Schmick's bartenders down to Bridgeport to teach them about this growing kind of, you know, interest in specialty whiskey, specifically single malt scotch. Let's pick it up there. So, you know, that how did those trainings go and where did things go from there?
As I said, we brought all the bartenders and managers to Bridgeport, and there was an interest in single malt scotch. When you think about, you know, beer is made from 100% malted barley, obviously so is single malt scotch. you talk to any brewers and they love their, you know, single malt scotch. So I knew there was a correlation, but I branched off. I spent about 2 years writing a column about craft beer for the Oregonian, but I also published my own newsletter. This is, you know, this is the late 1980s. We had newsletters back then. And I did that, and I called it Ushka Beha, which means water of life. And it was really the only information, in-depth information, that I felt was out there. And education was needed. As it turned out, the biggest booze company in the world, Diageo, saw this right when they were about to launch the classic malts. So Lagavulin, you know, Glenkinchy, Oban. And they asked me if I would do the same thing for them for the classic malts. And I go around the country doing, you know, tastings and seminars about their whiskeys. So this newsletter was published over in Southeast Portland. My wife did the design, I did the writing, and it said 2 Park Avenue in New York on the newsletter. It was actually 2861 Southeast Woodward Street. And it ended up going to 70,000 consumers during those, you know, late 1980s, 1990s, until Johnny Walker gave us a call and said, "You're selling too much whiskey. We're not selling enough Johnny Walker." So that was the end of that wonderful, lucrative gig.
Lucrative gigs are good, aren't they, Stuart? Once again, we're chatting with Stuart Ramsey, World Beer and Whiskey Authority. So from there, it seems, as I recall, you became the first U.S. Was the next thing in your journey you working with Whiskey Magazine, becoming an editor for them over the Britain edition of Whiskey Magazine? Oh, I may have this wrong. Help me out here.
A wee bit. By this time, you know, I'd written about, you know, Scotch whiskey, you know, blends and single malt scotches. British Whiskey Magazine, they contacted me and they said, "Would you write about Kentucky bourbon?" And because they're English, they didn't understand that Oregon, you know, was a few thousand miles from Kentucky. So I figured out a way to get to Kentucky, and during a course of about 6 or 7 years, visited, you know, all the distilleries in Kentucky, got to know all the distillers and everybody involved with bourbon and, you know, rye whiskey making. And it was through Whiskey Magazine that allowed me to do that. So by that time, it was getting to know, you know, I had the knowledge. I managed to visit every distillery in Scotland, 117 of them. Not as many quite in Kentucky. And what I loved about all of it when I got to Kentucky too was it wasn't just how great the whiskies could be, it was the people in the place and the culture and the food behind it, just the places in Kentucky and in Scotland. And that's what kept me going, and, you know, my love for that, that side of it.
Now, I've got to ask, so that's really cool. I mean, 170, I mean, I don't know anybody who's been to every Scottish or Scotch distillery in the world. So that's got to be, you've got to be one of a small grip of people that have been able to do that. What would you say are the key similarities to the culture around Scotch whiskey in Scotland and bourbon in Kentucky? Just that the cultures, the people around it, I'm just imagining their conviviality specifically is probably very similar, yeah?
It is, and you know, they're very grounded. You've had several generations in Scotland, in Kentucky, of people passing, you know, their sort of their secrets and their knowledge, and it just creates for this, you know, an atmosphere and a camaraderie that is different than you know, other communities that I've been in. Very rural for the most part. I mean, yes, there are, you know, distilleries, especially in Kentucky, like in Louisville, you know, in the cities. But just the handing down all that wonderful information one generation to the next, even in spite of prohibition and, you know, anti-alcohol movements and that type of thing, they've kept going. Beautiful cultures as part of it.
It's pretty cool. You know what? I just realized, you know, I've got you here. You know, I think a lot of my listeners enjoy whiskey, but I just want to jump into a quick, simple, foundational tutorial and just ask you a few basic questions about whiskey that maybe people take for granted that they don't know. So, I mean, just on a very base level, what is whiskey technically?
Well, technically, it's a spirit that when people talk about Irish whiskey, they talk about Canadian whiskey, talk about Japanese whiskey. They all come under the category or the umbrella of whiskey. They're basically all made essentially a beer, and they distill that beer. So the grain that goes into that beer will differentiate different, you know, whiskey categories, like a Japanese whiskey versus a Kentucky bourbon. But also the type of distillation plays a huge role in determining, you know, but they all come under this umbrella of whiskey. Even in Scotland itself, they'll say whiskey, and it might mean a single malt scotch, which of course is from one distillery, 100% malted barley, it, you know, basically distilled in these copper pots stills. A grain whiskey is made in a continuous method of distillation, which really all that means it's lighter, it's less complex than, say, one a single malt scotch. But when you create a blended scotch, you marry that lighter, more floral style of spirit with the bigger single malt scotch style of whiskeys. That's where you get blended scotch from.
And, you know, one thing, I've actually been a champion of blends in all whiskey categories, because I think we've kind of gotten to the single barrel. We've gotten into these kind of fetishization almost of the term single malt, single barrel, but blends can be equally as good as any single barrel or any single malt, right, Stuart?
I agree, and I think that you have to remember that a lot of the blends were designed as sort of mixing whiskies. I think the next stage and the next step, and certainly in Scotch whiskey, is you're going to see more and more better quality blends. They were kind of dumbed down, you know, generations ago, and they're coming back, and in terms of balance and versatility. The blended whiskeys are coming back, and something I look forward to.
Man, I tell you what, I do too. Specifically, you know who comes to mind is John Glazer, who's doing the Compass Box stuff. You know, like I always tell my bartenders, I think the next big thing in at least Scotch whiskey is the pure malt or vatted malt category, where it's a blend of single malts, and where the distiller or the blender can have massive control over the perspective of the whiskey that they want to make. Agreed?
Agreed. And I actually worked with John at Compass Box with the classic malts. So it's interesting how certain people, it's like Bridgeport, they're drawn to a particular company and then they leave the company. This is this American lad from Minnesota that moved to London and turned Scotch whiskey on its head, and make some of the greatest blended Scotch and blended malts coming out of Scotland.
Well, let me ask you this. We're kind of winding down on round three. Any particular whiskeys, give me two or three whiskeys that you're drinking right now that maybe somebody might find at a OLCC liquor store or a liquor store around the country.
Yeah, well, as I said, I always recommend one of the whiskeys from John Glazer. There's, in terms of Scotch whiskeys, one of the ones I'm intrigued about is this Monkey Shoulder from William Grant, which...
Sorry to jump in on you, Stuart. We're at the end of round three. We're going to pick that up in round four. Back at you in just a moment. And welcome back to the Liquid Lifestyle here on the Radio Northwest Network, where we are just enjoying a super smart and fun conversation with Stuart Ramsey, one of the world's leading authorities on all things beer and whiskey. And man, he's contributed so much to the beer and whiskey cultures here in the Pacific Northwest. If you've been sitting in through this entire show, you know, once again, he's been involved with brew pubs here in the Pacific Northwest since the very beginning. It actually helped develop the original Bridgeport Brew Pub, helped develop Blue Heron Pale Ale, helped create the Oregon Brewers Festival. And then in the last episode, last round, we were talking about kind of his movement into the professional whiskey space. But this, actually, you know what? Real quick, because at the end of the last round, we talked about, I just wanted to get a couple whiskeys, maybe some kind of whiskeys most people don't know about that you might recommend that people might pull off the shelf. shelf this weekend.
Yeah, in terms of affordable whiskies from Scotland, a rare thing these days, William Grant makes Monkey Shoulder, which is actually three different single malts married together. It's called a blended malt. It's about $30. And it's a lovely introduction to single malt scotch. It's real easy drinking whiskey. In terms of bourbon, Kentucky, one of my favorite whiskies right now, also around $30, is Henry McKenna, which is bottled in bond, which means it's 100 proof and 10 years old. And I just think those two whiskies are really great value and really good introductions into each style of.
Dude, thanks for that free consulting from Stuart Ramsey himself. So, man, I want to dive right into what you're doing right now. Whiskey Back. It's a new project you've been working on. Kind of puts together all of your passions, whiskey and beer, and puts together whiskey and beer in a pairing format. Tell me all about Whiskey Back.
So Whiskey Back is basically craft beer designed to pair up with different styles of whiskey. So the idea, and it actually evolved also over time, is that if you have a good whiskey, the right pairing of beer will actually fill in the gaps. So the first whiskey pairing I have is what the distiller would call himself, it's a good whiskey, and it's Cobegan, which is an Irish blend, much like a Scotch whiskey blend. So you pick the right beer, and this beer, the Cascadian Scottish Ale, is basically based on beers I grew up with in Scotland and the Bridgeport Blue Heron. So Belhaven 80 Shilling, Bridgeport, malty, fruity. The concept is it fills in the gaps of a good whiskey, so it gives the maltiness that might not be there through either, you know, it's youthful or it's, you know, a lot of what I call grain whiskey in it. When it's a single malt and a great whiskey, it just, they play off each other like call and response, and it's, you know, they celebrate each other. You sip the beer and then you sip the whiskey. You go back to the beer tastes a wee bit different, the whiskey. So you have this hopefully incredible taste experience between the spirit and the beer.
So really, it's like a nuclear intelligent Boilermaker situation is really what it comes down to. So you got this one right here. We're going to drink a little bit of the Kilbegan, which is a fantastic Irish whiskey, which you're pairing with your Cascadian Scottish or Scotch Ale.
Yeah, it's a Scottish ale. So it's not, it's you know, essentially close to a session beer with Golden Promise malted barley that I use, which is a great barley strain from Scotland, along with Northwest hops. So it's a wee bit of a hybrid. I'll put in some rye and some oats in there because I wanted to tie in with those grains that they used to make whiskey from. So it's based on classical beer styles, and then I tweak it so that there's some harmony between the flavors with the ingredients and with the actual spirit.
Dude, that's so cool. I've got one sitting right in front. We've got one sitting right in front. So tee me up for this, man. What do I start with?
You would basically start in the left hand with the spirit, with the whiskey, and take a sip of that. And then the right hand, you take a sip of the beer. And basically, after 5 minutes of doing that, you're talking to God. And since she's a Presbyterian, it's a collect call. And I don't think we use collect calls anymore. But this was inspired for me by old men in Glasgow drinking a blended scotch, and they'd chase it with a beautiful Scottish real ale like Belhaven, and also by nurses in Scotland who would drink double shots of Talisker in my pub in Glasgow and pints of Guinness, and every 10 minutes the bartender would nervously throw like a mutton pie onto the bar, and before they went on their shift at the local, you know, hospital, this is what they would do. And I fell in love with these beautiful nurses and their drinking habits. So that was a couple of inspirations. But you travel around America and you'll see different cultures. They'll call it a Boilermaker. I think in the old days the beer was better and possibly the spirits were better. But all I wanted to do is elevate it into, you know, good quality beer and good quality whiskey. Take it up a notch.
Dude, you've done that, man. We are at the end of round four. This flew, as always, Stuart. So awesome having you here. Everybody, get out there. Google Whiskey Back. Check out what he's doing. It's really, really special. I hope y'all have a wonderful evening out in P-Town tonight, and we will catch you next time.